after entering Diti's womb, Indra, with the help of his thunderbolt, cut into 7 pieces her embryo, which appeared like glowing gold. In 7 places, 7 different living entities began crying. Indra told them, "Do not cry," and then he cut each of them into 7 pieces again. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur remarks that Indra, by his yogic power, first expanded the body of one Marut into 7, and then, when he cut each of the 7 parts of the original body into the pieces, there were 49. When each body was cut into 7, other living entities entered the new bodies, and thus they were like plants, which became separate entities when cut into various parts and planted on a hill. The first body was one, and when it was cut into many pieces, many other living entities entered the new bodies. Translation again. After entering Diti's womb, Indra, with the help of his thunderbolt, cut into 7 pieces her embryo, which appeared like glowing gold. In 7 places, 7 different living beings began crying. Indra told them, "Do not cry," and then he cut each of them into 7 pieces again. Om Agadatara Mandyasya Padabjana Sarakaya Chakshura Manitam Yena Tadra Shri Guru Vedama. This chapter reveals the hideous nature of the original disease of the living entity, which is envy of Krishna, which expresses itself in all kinds of envy or all kinds of living entities. And it's very instructive. And then the chapter goes on to reveal the only cure for that original disease from which all others spring, envy, the Supreme Lord. So what does envy tell us about our lives and teach us about ourselves? Common sense is sufficient to understand that coveting another's gifts or position or qualities or possessions or anything is simply a pathway to conflict, and therefore we need to fill our minds with more positive thoughts. But we may rationalize that simply coveting what belongs to another is not harmful as long as we don't act on those desires. We know from Bhagavad Gita that while contemplating the objects of the senses, one becomes attached to them. That attachment, lust and hopes, lust transforms into anger because it can't be fulfilled. And then we become angry and frustrated. And smoldering, that anger turns into wrath. And then one's mind becomes bewildered. He can't discriminate right from wrong, good from bad. And thus he's dragged down deeper into the lower modes of material nature once again. And thus we have to redirect our consciousness, our thoughts, our desires to more positive, fulfilling, beneficial achievements. But the problem is actually deeper and more serious than that. When we're envious of others, which is a disease which threatens us all at times in life when we're not feeling really fulfilled, the intensity of illegitimate desires is a symptom of an emotional deprivation which requires attention. And then we have to consider, what is it that infatuates us with others' possessions or positions or qualities, or these days, I guess, just even a sense of confidence is something we envy in others, because people become more insecure. But what is it that infatuates us with others' possessions? Is it really anything necessary or better than what we have? The fascination with others' possessions and positions and gifts and qualities is not so much with the objects, but with the persons themselves. When we're feeling empty and doubting our own sense of worth, we tend to envy what appears to be the fullness and fulfillment that we perceive in others. And that obsession is due to a longing to fill our own internal emptiness with what someone else possesses, and a desire to take on the identity, or at least the part of it we lack ourselves. But what it really means is trying to become another person, which is not possible. You can't usurp such intangible qualities as satisfaction or peace or joy that we hanker for and see in others what we may be lacking ourselves. And so we conspire for the substitutes in the form of material possessions or material positions, and seek satisfaction with the outer trappings in others' lives. But the tragedy is that in so doing, we lose perspective on our own development by appropriating another's. And we miss the gifts in ourselves. Each and every living entity is a unique expansion of Krishna, with unique gifts and talents and abilities that no one else in creation shares, or not at least in an identical manner. And becoming obsessed with the gifts of another means you're going to miss those in yourself. So we have to learn from others by avoiding their mistakes and appreciate the good in others, but ultimately we have to live our own life and win or lose our own battles to seek out our own unique gifts based on a unique relationship with Krishna. So, understanding that his wife was envious in her desire to achieve a son who could kill Indra, Kashyapamuni, a very wise sage and must be an exalted devotee considering the kind of progeny he had from Aditi's sister, Aditi, sister and co-wife, who gave birth to such divine personalities as Garuda, Lama, there's so many demigods. But the process of purification, Diti was elevated to give birth to demigods herself. So the process outlined by Kashyapa Muni involves worshipping Lakshmi Narayan and respecting all others. And This is an education in Vaishnava etiquette, which is the protocol which should establish the behavior and interactions amongst devotees. And it's based on respecting others and expecting no respect in return. And what does that say? It means we want to protect the precious Bhaktivinoda Bija from the assault of the lower modes of material nature, which will bewilder our minds and take us further away from Krishna. When blessed with the seal of devotion by the grace of the spiritual master, and the process for nurturing that Bhaktivinoda Bija, beginning by Shravana Kirtanam, that very tender Bhaktivinoda Bija must be carefully protected in its initial stage when it's so tender and vulnerable. And the Vaishnava etiquette is a code of behavior which keeps relationships protected. It establishes a type of behavior governed by sattva-guna, which is conducive for developing the qualities of Shuddha-sattva, in which the fruits of the Bhaktivinoda Bija really manifest. So, the three modes of material nature are always competing with one another and competing for our attention. And we must first of all take control of our own thoughts, because it is thoughts that lead to actions, and actions foster reactions, and that affects relationships. So by the kind of gentle, non-envious behavior established in Vaishnava etiquette, we are protected from falling into the lower modes or envy. What is envy? Is it really a quality? It's really an absence. It's just the absence of love. And the ensuing overwhelming emotion is fear. Because envy means ultimately you're envious of Krishna. And to protect the sacrament of loving relationships, which is free will, which is a prerogative for love, Krishna has honored his system of free will by allowing us an option of being independent. False ego means the illusion of being independent from Krishna, having independent existence, independent desires, independent will, independent. What it creates is a whole separate world based on illusions and just full of fear, because the living entity, when he senses that he's cut off from others, from himself, from his roots, from his home, he's full of fear. And he tries to deny it and hide. But you know, the nature of fear, which is the quality of demons, which ultimately reside in the darkness of our own hearts. Demons, their power is based on fear. And if we run and hide from them, they just become more and more powerful, or gain more and more illusory power over us because of us surrendering to their illusory tactics. When the Israelites were, you know, approaching Canaan, and they sent their an advance party to see what the land was like, the promised land. And they came back and told stories about giants who were just so intimidating. And they just wanted to turn right around and go back to Egypt, the land of slavery, because at least it was safe from these giants that were wandering around in the promised land. And most of the advanced party was completely intimidated by the giants they saw. And the obstacles, like the walled city of Jericho and the river Jordan. But the successor to Moses, who was Joshua, he saw things completely different. He saw those giants in relationship to God, whereas the other generals were seeing those giants in relationship to themselves. Therefore, the other generals were just seized with fear. Where to Joshua, this was a challenge to see more and more the glory of the Lord and the words of the prophets, which had led them out of bondage and slavery in Egypt to the emotional bondage in Babylon and through the lost wanderings in the wilderness, and the prophets would always encourage them, don't forfeit your freedom by longing for the false sense of security back in Egypt. So when we see things in relationship to Krishna and behave with one another in our interactions based on the culture of the spiritual world, we're practicing, we're conditioning ourselves for the mode of goodness and protecting ourselves from lower modes, and we're also creating an atmosphere where to express lower modes would just be embarrassing. Srila Prabhupada sacrificed so much to create temples and communities where there would be a favorable atmosphere for loving relationships, which is a nurturing atmosphere for loving Krishna. And if we become slack in the principles and the rules and regulations and the etiquette and the respect due to others, or expecting respect for ourselves, violating the foremost principle of Trinada Pisanicha and Atodana Pisanicha, and gradually, imperceptibly, those lower modes start to take possession of our hearts, and we glide back down to where we were trying to extricate ourselves from. If you look at the history of New Vrindavan, there used to be the culture, the practice. You know, jivas are creatures of habit. Whatever habits you develop, just by repetition, that becomes fortified. So we're conditioned by material nature to interact based on the lower modes, passion and ignorance. And this is a disgrace to the spiritual society and the founder, Srila Prabhupada. So when asked how to recognize a devotee or a disciple, Srila Prabhupada said he's a gentleman. The Vaishnava etiquette trains us, conditions us in a good way to interact on the higher qualities of goodness, which is illuminating and which is next door to Shuddhasattva. It's like a springboard to the spiritual reality which we're seeking. In the old days, you know, it used to be in the morning, because most everybody would show up in the temple before Mangalarti, and whenever anybody came in, be a new bhakta or whatever, everybody would pay their obeisances. And it's interesting to watch how over the years the gestures have changed from actually bowing down and showing some respect, which actually fosters a feeling within the heart, because you're just defying your false ego that wants to proclaim, you should bow down to me, but if I bow down to you and confront that ego, because it, you know, it lives on you, terrorism and all the fear, that you're afraid to confront it, it's insurmountable. But that's seeing it in relation to yourself. You see it in relationship to Krishna and surrender to him, just bow down. You don't feel like it, but you do it as a sacrament, as a service. Then you have just confronted your false ego. And then Krishna rewards you. And how does it happen? Of course, we have to be careful not to trust Krishna, because when you just make the slightest gesture, he rewards you with a taste of the sweetness of his lotus feet, which means service. Even though you have no qualification, he gives you a taste, which means it's going to be hard to go away. But if you're determined and do, you're going to have a problem that nothing's going to have any taste or any substance once you've experienced the taste of the sweetness of Krishna's lotus feet, which comes through an experience of devotion and service. So even though we're very immature and unqualified, Krishna gives us a taste to encourage us. You don't have to surrender the false ego that you've been so afraid to confront with all the demons that brew in this darkness. Because we have a very powerful protector and guide. So over the years, it's interesting to see how it went from actually bowing down to just not quite getting over, but just, you know, nodding your head a little bit and folding your palms. And then it kind of goes to, you know, you just go wave. And then I've noticed, you know, very few people even wave each other anymore. What they do is they raise one finger. Just so casually. Like they don't really want to exert the effort, but really, so just kind of make some slight indication of respect. And then the next thing is you don't see them anymore. At least in the temple. So, this respectful attitude amongst Vaishnavas, even though you may not feel like you respect the individual, if you perform that service as a sacrament, as a sacrifice, to make sacred that relationship, then just by expressing a gesture governed indirectly by the mode of goodness, what you'll usually find is you actually evoke something of goodness from the person. Whereas I can just go challenge in an egotistic way, and what you usually evoke is an egotistic response. Then these reciprocations, these responses, is what fortifies our actions, our feelings, our conditions. So relationships is the ecology of the spiritual world, and therefore Vaishnava etiquette is so important to keep those relationships pure and holy by keeping Krishna in between them. So Kashyapa Muni gave Diti a process, a vow. Knowing this, he was full of material desire and envy, but Bhagavatam says, akama, sarvakama, mokshakama, whether you're free of material desires or full of material desires or desiring liberation, the only thing that's really worth doing is worshiping Krishna. Because all these desires are so superficial and really have nothing to do with the soul. You know, the lusty false ego wants to acquire this and that and be envious of what other people have and achieve and acquire, but at a point it all becomes so frustrating that we just want liberation. Just end it all. But that's not, none of that has to do with what the soul is yearning and longing for, loving relationships. And that can only be reestablished by cleansing the heart. Beautiful illustration, which is a powerful meditation and visualization to utilize to enhance our sadhana regarding the process of purification. Cleansing the Gundicha temple. Gundicha Marta. The Gundicha temple is a replica of Vrindavan within the city which corresponds to Dwarka, Jagannath Puri, where the Lord resides in great opulence. But he longs for the simplicity and the sweetness of Vrindavan, so there's a Gundicha temple named after King Duma's wife, which for all the 2 weeks of the year is closed and empty. And when the doors are closed, and that temple is uninhabited, it accumulates dust and sand from the shore infiltrating through the doors and windows. And it becomes gloomy and lifeless And like anything that's closed and lifeless and stagnant, it develops lower. Not that the temple can be contaminated, but the atmosphere. Because this is actually symbolic of a closed heart. When our hearts are closed to Krishna, and they're dark and empty and lifeless and stagnant and void. But it doesn't just stay a vacuum, because the anarthas, which is a subtle form of demons, like to grow in such an environment. And since we have closed our hearts to Krishna since time immemorial, and our closed hearts have bred so many anarthas, and we have so much fortified our ego with a wall to keep Krishna's mercy out, because that challenges our own imagined sense of separate existence, with all the fear and all the anguish and all the emptiness. Such a wall, such a barrier. We have made alliance with Maya to ban Krishna from our hearts. And Maya is the Lord's own divine energy. And she has fortified our hearts according to our desire in such a way we don't even know how to open them up again. It's beyond the ability of the mortal. And therefore, the process begins by surrendering to the agent of Krishna, who implants the seed of bhakti. By his grace, he gives the holy name. What is the holy name? It's our call to Krishna for help. But we don't call directly Krishna, the Hare Krishna. The energy of the Lord, the merciful divine energy, Radhe, Hare Krishna. And then the Lord, he accepts, out of his unlimited mercy, he accepts the invitation to enter our hearts, even though they're so dirty and dark and full of so many anarthas. He enters by the grace of his representative, because the Lord is the servant of his servants, and his merciful servants in this world want that we return to the light of Krishna consciousness and to the shelter of our homeland, and all the loving relationships are awaiting there. So, Krishna, in the form of transcendental sound, like the Srimad Bhagavatam, enters our hearts, and Krishna himself takes up the cleansing work. Just as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu one morning went to Kashi Mishra and the superintendent of the Jagannath Puri temple, he said, "I have a request for your servants. I want to clean the temple." That was a menial service. But we're your servants, whatever you want, we will fulfill. And the Lord indicated he wanted to lead the cleansing of the temple. So, opening the storehouse, which was King Prataparudra's order, they brought 100 brooms, 100 mops, 100 buckets filled with water, and another 100 on call. And Mahaprabhu, after decorating his servants with sandalwood and flower garlands and ornaments, he himself led the party. The Sankirtan party, because everything was based on the chanting. Even if you want, because you know, the devotees were crashing into each other and all these things, breaking the pots, they had to ask for another one. But nobody could ask for anything without first saying, "Hare Krishna, can I have a pot? Hare Krishna." Everything had to be preceded and followed by Hare Krishna. And then, Mahaprabhu taking those buckets, casting swirling arcs of water on the ceilings, flowing down the walls, across the floors, out the doors, cleansing the outside, taking his own cloth, and with his own tears, scrubbing everything. And after it was clean, it was so pure and cool and soothing and attractive, then he did the whole thing all over again. The first time they were collecting sand and straw and debris, and Mahaprabhu made every devotee make his little pile. And if he had a big pile, he'd say, "Very nice, you should teach others. If you didn't have enough, you should do better." And he'd fine them. Cakes and sweets. They had to pay a fine. Sweets and cakes to those who did better. And then, after throwing that all out and kept far, far away,
and they did it all over again,
which means after the gross material desires are cleansed from the heart, then there's the subtle desires. Profit, adoration, and distinction. Wanting to be respected. And if somebody says, oh, you did nice. Yes, I did. That means you're far, far away from Krishna. Krishna wants to glorify his devotees. But in our diseased condition, if somebody glorifies us, we think we're worthy, then you've just gone further away from Krishna. If someone glorifies you for something you did, understand, it was just a gift. If a senior devotee offers respects to a junior, it may be a breach of etiquette, but that natural humility in the hearts of the Vaishnavas has to be honored. What should you feel if a senior elevated devotee offers you respects? You should feel embarrassed. If you feel you deserved it, you're once again far from Krishna. When the devotees met, the Bengalis came to Jagannath Puri for Ratha Yatra. Mahaprabhu sent out his party of Vaishnavas to welcome them and embrace them, and everybody was bowing down and offering prayers and embracing one. A great festival of love. And then Mahaprabhu appeared on the scene. And he began glorifying each devotee. And the devotees were glorifying Mahaprabhu. But his glorification of the devotees exceeded the best of their glorification of him. They were defeated in their attempts to glorify him by his glorification of them. But he was glorifying them because he was defeated by them. In the festival of love, everyone wins. Everyone's defeated and everyone's happy. So after, cleansing the temple the second time, representing the Lord in our hearts, that work of removing all the subtle anarthas. You have to keep it clean by regular practice. Shinvata Swakata Krishna Pumishavana Kirtana Nirantam Stokya Vajrani Yidunoti Suritsitam. By regular hearing of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which must be accompanied by regular service to the pure devotee. All anarthas are destroyed, prakritam nil, and loving devotional service, our natural sentiment of the soul, is reawakened as an irrevocable fact. But regularity is essential, because we're creatures of habit. Whatever we do regularly becomes a habit and conditions us to whatever mode predominates that type of activity. And therefore, activities of service, of surrender, of sacrifice, of Vaishnava etiquette, and loving relationships based on respect, which brings out the best in ourselves and brings out the best in others. You may think, oh, he's got disqualifications, I should respect him. But that respect will bring out the divine gifts from within in both parties, and just create an atmosphere conducive and inspiring to developing love of God. Studying the Srimad Bhagavatam without service to the pure devotee was demonstrated in the life of... He was actually Bhandari Muni in Krishna Lila, one of the pundits in the court of Danda Maharaj. And in Gauralila, he was Devananda Pandit, who from birth was very pure and had great faith in God and just loved to study and teach the Srimad Bhagavatam. Very humble, good qualities. Perfect sense control, perfect gentleness. But he lacked faith in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his devotees. So one time in his Bhagavatam class, Srivas Pandit, in this very childlike, simple mood, was so attracted by the verses, and he entered the class and hearing the descriptions of his beloved Lord, just began crying and trembling, his hair just became frayed. He just fell on the ground, rolling in divine rapture. And the students of Devananda, what is this disturbance of the sentimental devotee? They dragged him out into the streets. And Devananda Pandit, he didn't protest. Soon thereafter, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu passing by Devananda's ashram just began. What is this fool doing teaching Srimad? He doesn't know anything about Bhagavad. Let me tear his manuscript to shreds. And he wanted to go in and tear it to shreds. And the devotee stopped him. No, this is... But later on, by the influence of Lakreshwara Pandit, who also came to his ashram, Lakreshwara Pandit danced. Lakreshwara Pandit is the incarnation of Aniruddha of the Chaturvyuha, but is also combined with one of Srimati Radharani's dear sakis. And when he danced, his gestures were so full of grace that Devananda Pandit was just enraptured. And he surrendered. And then he took a stick and he held back the crowds who were crowding in to see the divine gestures of Lakreshwara Pandit. Like angelic in every sense of the word. And he felt inspired in a mood of devotion and service. And then he understood the greatness of Mahaprabhu through his devotees. And then when Mahaprabhu returned 10 years after his sannyas to Navadvip Nam, to Kula, which is the vernacular for Koladi. Kulia, where all offenses are forgiven. And he was trying to hide in the house of Vidyavachaspati. But word got out. How can you hide the sun? Word got out. And then everybody was, the crowds were coming. And then someone said, when people heard that he's back, the crowds, they were just running. The streets were so packed, the people were just running through the jungles, knocking down the forests, making their own trails. And then they came to the Ganges, and the boats were waiting. A boat can hold, maybe 20 people. 200 people jumped in each boat, and they sank, but they didn't sink because somehow something held them up, and the people just ran. Somehow or other, they take banana trunks or water pots, somehow come across the Ganges. And then, I told you, don't tell me. I said, how can you not? So then he came out. And then he went back in after giving his darshan and just disappeared from Vidyavachaspati's house in Vidyanagar. And then the people were challenging Vidyavachaspati, what did you do? Where'd you hide him? So he was already devastated that the Lord had just disappeared from his home. And then the people were criticizing him in so many ways. What are you hiding him? And then they were giving it horrible analogies, like if somebody just comes into possession of so many sweetmeats and he won't share them, what kind of miserly person? He said, but he just disappeared. But then the word, he's in Kulia. And then those millions and millions of people that somehow got across the Ganges, sinking all the boats on the way, turned around and went back the other way, multiplying millions of times on the way. And then, look, as far as you could see, there was no Ganges, there was no land, there was no anything but heads, like unlimited people, just converging on Kulia. And then they were all begging forgiveness, because in that time of separation after Mahaprabhu left, like the universe had just become void and empty, and they realized, we didn't appreciate him, we didn't respect him properly, and he just left us. And even great offenders like Gopala Chapala, and then Devananda Pandit, who was revered through his life as such an ascetic, as such a scholar, but he missed the whole point. And he came and begged forgiveness from Mahaprabhu that I offended your devotee Srivas Thakur. And Mahaprabhu gave him the same instruction he gave to everyone. If with your mouth you have drunk poison, and it's starting to kill you, it's the only antidote is with that same mouth that you drink nectar. Then somehow you'll be able to digest and process and assimilate and evacuate the poison, but you'll become immortal from the effects of that divine nectar in the form of the chanting of the holy name. And then he led everybody in Big Harinam Sankirtan. So, but he also glorified, he said, Krishna Pandit, Krishna has made his home in his heart. When the Krishna Pandit dances, that's Krishna dancing in his heart. And the Krishna Pandit is just expressing what Krishna is doing within. And he told him, you cannot understand Bhagavatam without service to the devotee. The person, Bhagavat, is the living manifestation of the book Bhagavat. And the Bhagavat is only revealed to a surrendered soul. Srimad Bhagavatam is the embodiment of pure love, Krishna's literary form. Vyasadeva was so dissatisfied after he compiled all the Puranas and Vedas and Itihasas and Samhitas. He was so dissatisfied. And Narada Muni came and praised him for his achievements, but said, if it's so glorious what you've achieved, and you've done this for the welfare of others, why are you dissatisfied? And he asked, humble soul, you're right. You tell me. You have failed to explicitly emphasize the nectar and the pastimes in the holy names of Krishna and his devotees. And then Srimad Bhagavatam appeared from his heart. And from whom did Mahaprabhu always hear Bhagavatam? From Gadadhara Pandit. Whose disciple? Gopal. Young boy. Was so in love with Mahaprabhu, just to accompany him everywhere. And one day they were walking along the path, and Mahaprabhu stepped into the bushes. He had to answer the call of nature. But Gopal was alarmed. He didn't hear the chanting of the holy name. Mahaprabhu was always chanting the holy name of Krishna. So when he stepped into the bushes, Gopal was alarmed. He couldn't hear the holy name. And he jumped in the bushes and saw Mahaprabhu was holding his tongue. He said, what are you doing? He said, well, you know, when you answer the call of nature, you're impure. But if you don't chant Hare Krishna, how will you ever become pure? So Mahaprabhu let go of his tongue and kept chanting Hare Krishna, while at the same time explaining that you're my guru. That's why he's named thereafter Gopal Guru. Who, throughout his life, so faithfully, lovingly served his deity, Sri Sri Radha Radhakanta. But then later in his life, turned over the service of his deity to his beloved disciple, Dhyanachandra. And then, when Dhyanachandra was, see, when Gopal Guru Goswami left his body behind, and that body, that holy body was taken to be cremated. Just after lighting the cremation fire, the king's men, inspired by some kind of politics, came and usurped the temple and locked the doors. And Dhyanachandra was crying piteously that now my guru's left in the funeral pyre, and the doors to the temple were barred and closed and guarded by armed militant. He was just so crying so piteously that from the funeral pyre, Dhyanachandra he walked right out of the funeral, his own funeral pyre, and went right to the temple, negotiated with the soldiers to, you know, and solved the whole thing. And then right before everybody, he just went, walked back again into the funeral pyre and lay down in the cremation. And then at the same time in Braj, the devotees saw him there, immersed in some kind of intensive bhakti. So, when Balabhavat met Mahaprabhu Prayag, the Lord was so kind to him, just captivated his heart, that Balabhavat came to Jagannath Puri to have the Lord start continuing darshan. And meeting the Lord again there, began praising him with with prayers that are quoted by Srila Prabhupada. In the Kali Yuga, the fundamental religious principle is the chanting of the holy name. And unless one is empowered by Krishna, he cannot effectively propagate the chanting of the holy name, the Sankirtan movement. And Mahaprabhu in his normal humility, and also because he knew, as the indwelling guide, that after their initial loving exchanges, Balaram Bhatta had some little pride in his heart. That was very irritating. It was not nice for the Lord to reside there, so he wanted to purify that. So he began glorifying the devotees in the presence of Balaram Bhatta. Actually, it's not me, but I've been, by Krishna's mercy, purified by the association of Advaitacharya, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and is so expert in the six philosophical treatises that after teaching me Vedanta, he taught me pure bhakti, which is not exactly the way it went, but that's the Lord's vision. And this Nityananda is so intoxicated with praying. He's also the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this taught me that bhakti is the essence of all mysticism. Ramananda Rai is the ultimate knower of devotional mellows. And by his association, I've come to appreciate the mellows of Vrindavan, of which Srub Damodar is the very personification, and Haridas Thakur is the Acharya of the holy name. So, hearing Mahaprabhu glorify the devotees, all of Bhakti, because of that little tinge of pride in his heart, was feeling like a duck in the assembly of regal white swans. He thought, well, I need to get a little glorification for myself. So he came to Mahaprabhu shortly thereafter and told him that I have written my own commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, because I find Sridhar Swami's commentary inconsistent. Probably something to do with time, place, and circumstance. And Mahaprabhu was so unhappy to hear that. He said, Sridhar Swami is the original commentator of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Swami also means husband. One who does not follow the instructions of the husband is like a prostitute. I've also written a commentary on the holy names of Krishna. And Mahaprabhu said, I don't know much about the holy name of Krishna. I just know that Krishna's name is Shyama Sundar because of his beautiful dark complexion like a tamal tree, and Ashramati Nandana. I don't know about all these names. So Balabhata was thinking that he was so kind to me in Prahada, but now he's changed. And I'm just feeling so minimized. I must restore my sense of self-esteem. So he approached Gadadhar Pandit, the internal energy. And Gadadhar Pandit is so weak, so humble. When Balabhata began strongly explaining to him his commentary in the Srimad Bhagavatam, his commentary in the holy names, Gadadhar Pandita was thinking, Krishna, Lord Chaitanya is the indwelling super soul in the hearts of all. I do not fear him because he knows the circumstance, but his devotees are very critical. Lord, save me when it becomes known that I'm hearing what Mahaprabhu has rejected. I'll be an outcast to the devotees. So he's praying, Krishna, please protect me. He's a learned scholar, this fellow, but I don't want to hear this. So, then, Mahaprabhu, he refused to associate with Gadadhar Pandit. It was just so heartbroken. But then Balabhata came to understand by his association that when you're in a diseased condition, you can't understand what's good for you. I've become infected by pride. And Mahaprabhu is curing my blindness by anointing me with his kindness. And then he felt like, just like Indra, was favored by Krishna by thwarting his sacrifice so they restore him to the same condition of life. So then, when Balabha Bhatta invited Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for lunch, Swarup Damodar, Jagannanand Pandit, and Damodar Pandit, Balabha Bhatta wanted to take initiation from Kadatha Pandit. Pandit said, no, I cannot do anything independent of the Lord's desire, you have to ask him. And when the Lord heard that Balabha Bhatta had taken shelter of Kadatha Pandit, and he called for Kadatha Pandit. And Swarup Damodar went to get him, and on the way, Swarup Damodar said, he neglected you and rejected you for something that was not actually your fault. Why didn't you say something? He said, no. He's omniscient. He knows everything, and he's my master, and it would not look good for me to say something. And when he came to lunch, Mahaprabhu was there, and Gadadhar Pandit just offered obeisances with tears flowing from his eyes. Mahaprabhu picked him up and embraced him and began to praise him in the midst of all the devotees. You were not bewildered by my tricks. You remained fixed in your simplicity and you have purchased me. And for which he has become famous throughout the world for his gentle, submissive, humble behavior, for which he became known as Gadad, for which Mahaprabhu became famous as Gadadhar Pandita, the life and soul of Gadadhar Pandita. So, when actually, Srila Prabhupada says that it's by Indra's mystic cities that he cut the embryo into seven pieces and then did so again. There is a place where one attains the perfection of the mystic cities called Siddhashram. It's where Lord Kapiladeva sat and achieved enlightenment. And in Braj, this is a wonderful story about pride in Braj, because there was a terrible argument one day between Srimati Radharani and her dearly beloved brother Sri Dhamma, which ended up in cursing and counter-cursing to the extent that the Brijabasis had to endure 100 years of separation from Krishna. So, this is from Garga Samhita, it's explained that on the 100th year, to the day, when Srimati Radharani was sitting in her usual, or lying in her usual broken-hearted condition on the bank of Jamuna, and her friend was singing to her the glories of Dwarka, and something about the holy place, Siddhashram, caught her attention, and she said, what are the merits of bathing in that holy place? And her friend told her, you must have implicit faith in my words if you want me to reveal that benediction. And it caught her attention all the more. And her friend told her that anyone who bathes in that holy place of Siddhashram is awarded the benediction of never being again separated from Krishna. And that revived the life that had been like in a comatose condition for 100 years. And she just sat right up and said, well, we went to Kurukshetra to see Krishna there. Why don't we just go on to Dwarka and have his darshan there? And go to this holy place, Siddhashram, which is near Dwarka, and bathe in those holy waters to attain the eternal benediction of never being separated again from Krishna. So all the gopis who would do anything to relieve her of the torment that she had been suffering, just very quickly packed all the necessary paraphernalia and did the necessary cooking, and in no time there was a long caravan meandering through the deserts and pastures of forests like a long trail of hope, sustained by the words that Krishna told the devotees after all that cursing and counter-cursing, "You will see me again." They were sustained by that hope. And on the way, the clouds in the sky became the complexion of Krishna. The flowers in the fields were like the delicate smile on his face, and the bumblebees were like his restless lotus eyes. And then, one day, after a long journey, when hope blossomed in their hearts due to the aroma of that holy place where Kapila had attained the perfection in yoga, and those Vrijavasis, Srimati Radharani went to take her bath in the kund, and the gopis made like a silk curtain around that holy place. Meanwhile, in Dwarka, Krishna had his messengers keep track of every single movement of this caravan. And he became so lost in the movements of the Vrijavasis that he forgot he was in Dwarka. And he said, "Let's go to Siddhashram," not for any particular reason. There's no solar eclipse or any reason. But he led his mighty army of the Jadus to Siddhashram in the very nice pastoral scenery and tranquility. It was a pleasing relief to the Jadus, who set up their camp and then went to bathe in the Kund. And we're astonished to see this silk curtain made of these young gopis who told the great Jadu warriors, "No, you can't go there." They didn't know why. They didn't tell them why. But the Jadus were amazed to find that their great empowered military strength had just been completely thwarted by these little gopi girls. "What is going on here?" And then they had the queens go and inquire while the queen of Vrindavan is bathing. So then the queens wanted to, have a darshan of the queen of Vrindavan. And when they went to the Kund, all they could see was the golden waves and the beauty reflected everywhere. And then Satyabhama began extolling her own beauty and qualities, which has captivated Krishna to become her husband. And questioning, "Is there only one vessel of pure love for Krishna? What about all his queens who have made Krishna our own husbands? So who is this queen of Vrindavan?" And then Krishna said, "Because, Queen of Vrindavan, that could be Vrinda, that could be Tulsi." But Krishna said, "No, it's the daughter of Kalavati and Vrishabhanu." And they'd heard so much about her. And then when she came out of the water, the sun, the illumination of the sun, receded before her splendor and luster. And the whole forest swayed to the movements and the divine gestures of her. And Krishna's heart was singing within, "And now your journey has come to an end." And then everyone saw that her matchless beauty is due to her matchless love for Krishna. And in a voice quivering with love, because Lalita had told her, "Don't appear to be too anxious in the public," she said, "Now all my years of sorrow, all my years of penance and tapasya and worship has borne fruit. Because fortunate are those whose eyes behold you, my Lord." And then she offered such respect to all the Yadus who had just been totally paralyzed by her superior strength and bewildered. But they were so enchanted by her humility and her appreciation for all the others. And then the queens, they wanted to introduce themselves. Satyabhama and Rukmini said, "Why don't you come to our camp? You ride on my palanquin to our camp and let us serve you." She didn't really want to go there, but she had to accept the hospitality. And then that night, when Rukmini came to Krishna's tent to massage his lotus feet to help him to sleep, she saw that he wasn't even anywhere near ready to go to sleep. He was very pensive. He was very thoughtful. He seemed very concerned about something. And she asked, "Why have you not prepared to enter into the realm of sleep?" And he said, "Well, you queens don't really know the ways of the Brijavasis. They're simple cowherd girls, and they can't really sleep unless they drink hot milk." So Rukmini didn't know that. She ran back to the tent, boiled some milk. Satyabhama took it in a golden cup, offered it to Srimati Radharani with ice. And then they sat, talked, Krishna Katha, until Srimati Radharani and the gopis entered into the realm of Yoga Nidra. And then Rukmini came back and saw that Krishna was preparing to take rest. And when she began to massage his lotus feet, she was appalled to see they were blistered. She said, "My Lord, what has caused these blisters? It's not a hot day. It's a very cool and soothing path you've tread. What is the cause?" And he explained that I'm the presiding deity in the heart of my beloved. I am bound by the ropes of her affection. And out of respect, she honored your offering of hot milk. But it was too hot. She didn't say anything, but I was scalded." And Rukmini was just sort of shocked. And then, after that, the queens were so enchanted by the superior beauty, which is just the manifestation of the superior love of these Brijavasis. They wanted to know more and more about this Braj Bhakti. And feeling that their position as Krishna's queens, Krishna was just acting, he was playing a role. But he wasn't really there. At night, they'd hear him calling out to cows, and his cowherd boyfriends, and his cowherd girlfriends. So the queen saw that he's not really even with us at all. He's really not even conscious of us. He's off in Vrindavan with his cows the whole time. And the pride in their own hearts, which was also for Krishna's pleasure. It's just, it like had been hit by a tsunami wave, which just washed away all the impediments and revealed something more beautiful and splendid than they had ever imagined. So then they asked Krishna, "Could we enact some of those pastimes here? Like, we've heard about this Rasa Lila. We would like to participate." And Krishna said, "Well, don't ask me, ask her. That's her realm." And she said, "Yes, that'd be nice." So all the gopis directed the queens on how to participate in Rasa Lila there at Siddhashram. And it was such an experience that the queens in Dwarka thought this must be the highlight of any spiritual experience and communion that's ever transpired in the history of creation. And to verify, they asked Srimati Radharani. She said, "No, actually, it was like, in a very eloquent way," she said, "basically, it was a real letdown." And they couldn't imagine, how can that be? And she said, "Because where is the Jamuna, whose endless flowing waves are like poetry, creating an atmosphere which enchants Sri Krishna with the melodies of devotion? And where is Govardhan, with his caves and fruits and flowers and vegetables which give pleasure to the cows? And where is the forest of Kalpa Rishis, which produces the fruit of love of God in the unique form of Braj Bhakti?" So even though Krishna participated, it was nothing like it is in Vrindavan. So, and most of all, where were those distinctive qualities of the gopa, his flute, his peacock feathers in his tie, his stick for herding the cows. So with those words, it was like a wave of wonder had just swept away all the pride, even though it was a pride which is for Krishna's pleasure in the hearts of the queens, and bestowed a revelation to all the Dwarkavasis about the superior nature of the love of the inhabitants of Vrindavan. So, Srila Prabhupada has come to transplant that Braj Bhakti into Western soil. And New Vrindavan is the place he chose to install the holy dham in the West. But to create an atmosphere favorable for cultivating Bhakti Matabhita in the heart, you must scrutinizingly practice the principles of Vaishnava etiquette to keep all our interactions and our relationships pure and holy. Because really Krishna reveals himself in relationships. In the early days, when artists made depictions of Krishna up in the clouds or whatever, it's not Krishna. Where is his cows? Where is the cowherd boys? At least there has to be Jamuna. Krishna's never alone. He reveals himself in relationships. And sadhana bhakti and Vaishnava etiquette is the practice which keeps our hearts, our relationships, at least guided by Sakyagun. With these lower modes which fester envy and enmity and cruelty, they have no atmosphere to live. The Bhakti Lata Bija, which we're cultivating, will produce its own fruits in time. And that is how we recognize the Vaishnava. By their fruits, we shall know them. And what are the fruits? It's got nothing to do with the kind of position and possessions we get envious of in this world. What identifies a Vaishnava is his humility, his compassion, his gentleness, his sweetness, and love. So these are the things that attracted us to Srila Prabhupada. But if we really want to represent him and serve him, we have to uphold the dignity and the sanctity of his mission with proper behavior, etiquette, and relationships of our own. And that will create an atmosphere favorable for the chanting of the holy name, the cultivation of the Bhakti Matabhija, and its revealing its ultimate fruits of love of God in time. But remember, as Mahaprabhu said, a tree adorned with precious fruits, just like a person adorned with precious qualities, the jewels of love of God, does not stand erect in pride, but naturally bows down in humility, offering all respects to others, not expecting any return. And in that state of mind, one can chant the holy name constantly. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
You mentioned in some of Gadara Pandit, not reacting to Mahaprabhu. And here also Gadara Pandit is from Sri Rani, who always makes, in that Krishna's Kaviraj described it, oh, you're in
the place
like Rukmini, where Sri Rani had the opposite name.
Satyabhama.
Yeah. Could you comment on that?
Gadara Pandit has two predominant features according to the mood of Mahaprabhu. And Mahaprabhu is in the mood of Krishna. Gadadhara Pandit is in the mood of Radha. And Mahaprabhu is in the mood of Radha. That means he's plundered the heart of Radha and become her. Then Gadadhara Pandit is the shadow of what's left. Rukmini. So, generally, Mahaprabhu is in the mood of Srimati Radharani. When Mahaprabhu is in that mood, what was left was the shadow, which is Rukmini, which is the mood that predominantly prevailed in Ganadhara Pandit, that of Rukmini. That's what's left after Mahaprabhu has plundered the treasure of her heart in personified of himself. What's left, the shadow of what's left, is Rukmini, which is what Ganadhara Pandit represents in Mahaprabhu's in the mood of Radha. Well, Ramachandra Puri is really a Nityasiddha. It's Chitila, who always makes the devotees uneasy, or at least Krishna uneasy. So, when you're talking about Nityasiddhas, you know, performing their role in this world, they're not duty-bound to repent. But when you're talking about conditioned souls, and that's why devotees have to be very sober anyway, for conditioned souls. For Ramachandra Puri, it looked like offense. He definitely did everything that we're not supposed to do and set a precious example for as far as what we have to avoid. And how criticism of the Vaishnavas leads to criticism of God, because that's actually where it stems from. It's all the same thing with different faces. But Ramachandra Puri, he's Chitila, you know, he always makes Radha and Krishna very uneasy. That's his Leela, Nityasiddha. But in Kulia, we're talking about conditioned souls. So they came to realize that their behavior was not pleasing to the Lord. Ramachandra Puri, Mahaprabhu appreciated it, because he understood what he was in Krishna Leela, and it was just enhancing his Leela, even though to the devotees it's still painful. Mahaprabhu knew what's going on in the eternal realm. Whereas in Kulia, he left Navadvip Dham. He took sannyas and left Navadvip Dham, largely because people were criticizing him with envy. And it was really those who avoided him. And in that avoidance, their own insecurities and fears have just so clouded the natural appreciation of anybody who actually had his darshan. So there was just festering such criticisms. And then when they were criticizing him for actually chanting the names of the Vrijavasis, what are you doing? Just chant the name of Krishna. And then and the conspiracy to beat him. The nectar just turned into poison because of offenses. So he knew that 10 years of separation would put them in such a contrite condition, seeing the consequences of their offenses, that the Lord had left them. In that contrition of the heart, gravity, repentance, and soberness really fosters a deepened sense of humility. And when he returned, they had been so purified in that fire of separation that he was able to give the proper prescription for chanting the holy name in a humble state of mind, carefully avoiding offenses. And they were very receptive, because they didn't want to go through that fire of ordeal again. So, can't really compare a Nityasiddha to a Sadhana Bhakta in all ways. Some ways you can, but there's also inherent differences. Anything else? Yes.
I'm not necessarily very well, but does watch out for him and to become a Vaishnava after?
He was forgiven. He also attained forgiveness at Kula. That's why it's famous as a place where offenses are forgiven. He was forgiven. So from that we can assume he became Vaishnava. But then from another sense, you know, anybody in the whole universe at that time was liberated. Even those who had no contact whatsoever with Mahaprabhu. So what to speak of those who interacted with him, even unfavorably. They became eligible for that which is, in all other ages, in all the universes, completely unattainable, Raja Bhakti. So Gopal Sattva also attained forgiveness, from which we can assume he went on to attain Bhakti.
Said one should not hear blasphemy of Vaishnavas. So, if one's not sure if it's going on or if it's subtle criticism of Vaishnavas, how does one, I mean, you're supposed to go away, but sometimes you can't walk away or refuse to listen.
Well, the first recourse is to cut out the person's tongue and commit suicide, but in a preaching mission, that might not be conducive, because we're already seen as being a little bit fanatical. Not that we are, but sometimes people see the Lord as being a little fanatical. We shouldn't be fanatical, but sometimes people see us like that. So if we start, so it's like, you know, blasphemy is pretty rampant these days. We just cut out everybody's tongue and commit suicide. The preaching is not going to flourish. So for the sake of preaching, we avoid that one. The next one is leave a place holding your ears chanting Krishna Krishna. Sometimes you can't do that because of some awkward circumstance. But then it's quite, you know, blasphemy is what? Blasphemy means a type of criticism which is has a vicious motive. There's other kinds of subtle criticisms and cynicisms that it's not so black and white. We want to avoid hearing criticisms because what it does is it minimizes your faith. It undermines your faith. Psychologically, when you hear someone criticize a devotee, your feelings toward that devotee change. Your sense of faith and trust is undermined despite the psychological effect of hearing criticism. So you want to avoid it at all costs. If circumstantially you just can't avoid it, then you want to counteract it by, you know, really fortifying yourself with hearing and participating in singing the glories of the devotees. But there's another element, and that is that whether it may or may not be true, especially amongst senior devotees, when we hear criticisms, we can consider this is some kind of lila. It's just over my head. So I'm not going to take sides. I'm not going to try to evaluate it. I'm just going to try to protect myself from, you know, by going to those who will just fill my ears and hearts with the glories and appreciations of the devotees. So there's all kinds of different circumstances in this age. And in the preaching mission, you know, where critical thinking is needed, there's going to be disagreements. And those disagreements may lead into some kind of criticism. So, but there is a type of criticism which is aimed at correction and betterment, which we should all be seeking. So you can't just, you know, consider that all type of criticism is necessarily negative. Some of it has betterment as the desired outcome. It has to be handled so carefully. It has to be handled by those who actually do want betterment of the situation as a result. But most of all, you know, we in the Kali Yuga, which is an age of faults, where criticisms and blasphemies are just rampant, we're going to be exposed to these things. Some of the circumstances, it's just unavoidable. It just pervades the atmosphere. We have to keep ourselves continuously fortified by a dedication to the principles that Srila Prabhupada established. The morning program is such a fortification to protect the heart. The deity worship is not a process of self-realization for this age. It's for another age. But one of the glorious aspects of Harinam Sankirtan is it makes the Yuga Dharmas for other ages, meditation, sacrifice, deity worship, they become auxiliary means of self-realization to the prime means of chanting the holy name. So we have this environment where we come together and focus on the deity, glorify the deity. The morning program, it fortifies our hearts, or rather, fortifies and fills with such an atmosphere of nectar that protects us from that poison. So, sadhana is a kind of conditioning. It's a kind of spiritual conditioning. You have to continue it. Every day. Even the Nitya Siddhas, the Haridas Thakur, Raghunath Das Goswami, were so strict in their sadhana, even though they're liberated souls. They didn't need, and Mahaprabhu even said to Haridas Thakur, you don't need to do it. But he identified that the real disease is that you become slack in your vows. And that leads to all kinds of other diseases. So in the event, and in an absolute sense, we can't really totally avoid the contamination and the cynicisms and criticisms that pervade and surround us. But we have to displace them by making the heart so filled. Srila Prabhupada, you see in the illuminations of the Bhagavad, they love these natural allegories and lessons from nature. The rice paddy. Of course, he used it in different ways. But he said, he used the analogy of a rice paddy. The rice paddy is surrounded by a dike. And the rice is planted in the water. And the rice grows and thrives in the water. But if that dike gets broken, or the water goes down and it dries out, then the rice doesn't grow, the weeds do. And if it's not tended to immediately and it gets more dry, the ground cracks and then it won't even hold water anymore. So Srila Prabhupada used this analogy to visualize, to teach, and utilizing the visualization, how we have to keep our hearts so filled with the nectar of devotion that whatever impurities we have to encounter, whatever contamination which we're inevitably encounter in the world, it will not pollute. It will not have a place to take possession and control, because our hearts will be so filled with the nectar of devotion. And Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Adasayanam, and all the other processes which Srila Prabhupada has. So it's a matter of keeping yourself fully engaged in devotional activities that protects us from the unavoidable. We should avoid whatever we can, but what cannot be avoided has to be compensated by keeping our sadhana very, or as the Srimad Bhagavatam says, our devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self and protect the self. The influences, the unavoidable influences of the age of Kali. They're unavoidable, the influences are everywhere, but we can protect our hearts by keeping them filled with devotional topics, devotional thoughts, so they don't really have a place to reside.
Should we just assume we don't want criticism in the
Well, no. We have two equal duties to truth and humility. If we're being criticized for something that's not true, we have a duty, in a humble way, to reveal that, well, that's not true. Because so often people, you know, formulate their opinion just by hearing one side of a story. But there's never one side of a story. There's always two sides. So, and oftentimes that other side needed to be expressed. So if somebody formulates an opinion based on hearing one side of the story and they're accusing you, and it's just wrong, you have equal duties to truth and humility. They're inseparable. They're like consorts, truth and humility. So if something's just plain wrong, you have not only a right, but a duty to say, well, it's wrong. But you have to say it in a humble way. If you say it in a defensive way, then you're kind of testifying that it's right. By your defensiveness, by your reaction, your words say it's wrong, but your actions say it's right. So how does that help? With humility, if you can not react, but respond with, you know, your version, but protected by humility, then it'll have a healing effect, a redemptive effect. So if something is just plain wrong, you don't just say it's right as a matter of humility. You say, well, you know, that's not the way I see it, or that's, you know, maybe missing a certain piece of information which needs to be considered. But that truth has to be presented in with humility. Otherwise, it's not going to hold much credence. If it's reactive, and, you know, fortified with defensiveness and anger, it's going to look like, well, you know, you are guilty. So humility is power. And it's the necessary companion of truth. And truth is a necessary companion of humility. So you have equal duties to truth and humility. Don't just say something, you know, agree that something's right when it's really wrong. Express your version, but keep it purified by humility.
Or sometimes the consciousness, I guess, sometimes creeps in amongst people or self, maybe, that the etiquette might be, if we want to be natural, so, or practical, or we might think about etiquette, certain etiquettes. Could you comment on that?
Natural? Yeah, we want to be natural. But there's different kinds of nature. There's conditioned nature and there's divine nature. So yeah, we want to be natural. But what kind of nature do we want to be natural to? The divine. So, oh no, it's not natural according to my conditioning. So I respond by that conditioned nature. And then you're evoking a conditioned response and you're fortifying the conditioning by the relationship, by the interaction. But that's what we're trying to get away from. That's what we're trying to transcend. So we're given a code, a protocol to follow to uplift us and protect us in the higher modes of divine nature. But the wonder in that is that even though it may appear, you know, unnatural according to conditioning, yeah, it's unnatural that I respect that person. And it's unnatural for him to be respected. And then it's more unnatural that when he's respected, he responds with a respectful attitude and respectful words. So, following the protocol, observing the etiquette, may seem unnatural to our condition to the lower modes, but is natural to the soul. So that's what we're trying to practice until we actually, you know, become conditioned to the higher modes, which, you know, reveals our own inherent nature of devotional relationships. But the wonder is that even though it may not appear natural, you do it. not in a pretentious way, but as a sacrifice, that, you know, to make sacred our interactions by following the proper standard. Then that evokes something higher from within your own heart. It evokes something higher from the heart of the other, and it invokes something transcending both of you, which is Krishna. I mean, just look at the way you can interact. You know, if somebody's angry and you just get resentful and angry back and defensive, if you're just reinforcing the lower moments of conditioned relationships and conditioned responses. But if somebody's just angry and emoted, and you utilize your free will to see this differently, that person is hurting because he doesn't really believe in Krishna's love. He's fearful because he feels separate. And some little gesture of acceptance and welcome and kindness can completely transform, first of all, it'll protect you, and then it'll evoke something higher from the other person, and it'll invoke something transcendent to both of you, which is Krishna, who reciprocates for those kind of interactions. So it may appear unnatural to our lower conditioning, to the three modes, but it is most natural and most pleasing to the higher condition which we're trying to revive in our hearts. Devotional relationships. Anything else? Well, part of the tragedy in, you know, envying another and wanting to usurp what is it about that person that we think will be fulfilling to ourselves, you lose your own identity by trying to take on another's or even an aspect of another person's identity. And envy is that wanting, you know, to take over an aspect of that person's identity. The tragedy in that is you lose sight of your own. And it's only your own identity with your own struggles that's going to rectify your relationship with Krishna. So you lose perspective of the whole path by succumbing to that kind of condition. So it's a tragedy. You like become someone else. And you fight someone else's battles, and you don't achieve your own victories and successes. Or what to speak of. Realize your own gifts. If you're too preoccupied looking at somebody else's, you don't realize your own. If you're too envious of another's treasure, you don't realize your own. But conversely, and divinely, if you do appreciate another's gifts, then you're cultivating some of that in yourself. And that helps you to see your own better. So appreciation, you know, envy is just like a syndrome that just like drags everything down. But appreciation, by appreciating another's gifts, you're partaking in them yourself. And you're opening your eyes to your own gifts. And that's why it's so important that if you have to point out some fault in a person, some weakness, fortify it by reminding the person of their strengths, ideally before and after the weakness has to be pointed out. Because if you just go to somebody who's just so feeling so weak and so fearful and so disconnected and start harping on their weakness, they're going to try to defend themselves and hide and avoid and everything that's just not conducive to anyone. But if you remind them, you have weaknesses. I mean, you have strengths. Then you're going to build up some courage that then I can overcome my weaknesses, like God's grace, if I do have this. So remind them. You got strengths. You got tremendous resources. There's tremendous mercy to work with. And then you're going to want to become, you're going to inspire the other person to want to overcome their weaknesses by realizing we've got better resources to work with. but just to zoom right into the weakness when the person is already feeling weak, and disconnected, and unloved. It's not conducive to anybody's upliftment. So you see in the pastimes of Mahaprabhu, I read all the pastimes of Mahaprabhu, you know, as a young pundit, he was just like a lion just roaming around Navadvipa. And it was you know, pointed out many times that it was very similar in the case of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. But Mahaprabhu was the young pundit, Nimaya pundit, before his initiation, especially, just roaming around Nadia like a lion, just looking for any professor. And they would do anything to avoid him. And he'd also go after the devotees, get out of their party and try and run. You go, grab him. You're so expert in poetry. Let me. And then, oh, no, you're. So you. But the thing, and Keshav Kashmir actually explained this more wonderfully, or just, get, you know, put it right in the conclusive words. You destroyed my pride, but you didn't destroy my dignity, my spirit. You kept that intact. And therefore he understood, this is Krishna. Because only Krishna can destroy one's pride while keeping his dignity, his honor, and his spirit intact. You don't want to destroy the devotee with his pride. You want to destroy the pride and uplift the devotee. So we have these wonderful examples of etiquette to follow. But it has to be ideally preceded and followed with affirmation of the person's strong points. Then he's going to feel like, I got something to work with to overcome these weaknesses. And he's not just going to put up the walls and the defenses and just cut himself off when he's already feeling cut off. So as a gesture of compassion in the event of having to point out someone's defects and weaknesses for them, fortify them first and after with affirmation of their strengths. Then they'll know, I can overcome the weaknesses, and the person has some goodwill for me. It's not just an attack. It's an expression of compassion. And then, above and beyond your own best, that brings Krishna to the scene. Who's attracted by those kind of interactions. And he just redeems all shortcomings. Of course, this goes for addressing yourself, too, in your own internal dialogue. You know, people who get just obsessed with their own shortcomings and weaknesses, that's what they're cultivating, by their thoughts. Your thoughts are the building blocks of your consciousness. Your consciousness is the substance of your relationships. So, you know, when your own internal dialogue gets all preoccupied with your own weaknesses and faults, well, you got to address that. Well, you know, I do have strengths also, by God's grace, so let me, you know, consider them and focus on them. It's not that we don't acknowledge the weaknesses. Acknowledge, but don't dwell. Dwell on the strengths. Dwell on the virtues, the good, the holy, the uplifting. From there, the other is kind of a fade into proper perspective from which it can actually be redeemed and healed. All right. Thank you very much, Lord Glorious Srila Prabhupada.
Before the next question,
Lord Maharaj.
Another person or another situation, but the actual act of envy that's keeping you from the happiness from Krishna.
It's also barring you from your share of those purchases. Appreciation, by appreciation, you take a certain part of the produce into yourself just by the mere act of appreciation. But the mere act of envy bars you from any absorption of those of that good.
Hey.
Because it's misuse, and Krishna doesn't want to encourage that.
Okay. But even
it's misuse.
If you think you're going to be happy by getting those things, that's the illusion, the trick, because there's no way you can be happy by getting things that
it's
not due to you.
On externals because, you see the externals as a substitute for the deepest internal, like the satisfaction they promise but don't present.
Right. I got you a lot of fruit.
Thank you. That's what I need.
Yeah. Do you want other stuff too? Did you?
Know?
I'll go get you some more. I was going to bring some this morning and I forgot it because I was in a hurry and I thought about it. Are you feeling better?
I want to raise some garlic on that grass. I don't know.
I know. I'm. That what?
Well, no, my bones.
Do you feel better?
Yeah.
It makes a difference, doesn't it?
Well, I can't say for sure that's what it was. I can't say for sure that there was a feeling at that point.
Yeah.
And I can't say for sure that it tasted like it was extremely important.
Mm-hmm. I know, it's strong. It's organic. Grown by devotees. Okay, I'll make sure to get some more.
Well, I'm glad you're aware that it happens. Sorry, I spent so many episodes of this friend of mine, mutual frustrations, but I think that's kind of like dispelled now. Concentrate on positive growth, right?
Yeah.
And I see positive growth, too. So.
I think.
Sometimes you just got to get all this stuff out before you can do it.
I think I've been giving Tapa a lot of. Lobelia and valerian, and it's mellowed them out. It's been actually, I think, it's helped a lot. He thinks it's worth calling.
Well, it costs a lot of
money. Right. Do you want other prasadam too?